This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The environment is always one of the casualties of modern war, but in this war, the environment is being held hostage by Saddam Hussein, who has threatened to blow up the oil fields of Kuwait if Iraq is invaded. Three oil installations are already burning. Scientists from around the world are alarmed by the environmental disaster that could be caused by the resulting inferno if Saddam Hussein follows through on his threat. World Watch Institute monitors the environmental state of the world and publishes an annual report. We asked World Watch's chief researcher, Christopher Flavin, about the environmental damage he feared might be caused by each side in this war.
It truly is an environmental killing ground that we're looking at in the Middle East here, and I think it's really the big picture that creates the most worry. I mean, you have the potential to have environmental degradation result throughout the region, and unfortunately, it's the kind of situation where it is unlikely that there will be an ability to deal with it in the near future. And that has direct human consequences. It's not as if we can separate out the environmental costs from the human costs in all of this. Ultimately, a degraded environment is going to directly affect the people throughout the region.
What regional effects are you most worried about?
Well, regionally, there is a tremendous potential for air pollution to cause serious health problems. The Iranians have already found that they are getting a fallout of soot from these burning oil wells up to 150 and 200 miles downwind from the actual area where the fires are occurring. In addition, the deposit of enormous amounts of toxic materials out of these clouds into the Persian Gulf and onto land areas will cause serious contamination that, for example, could affect the food supply that comes out of the Persian Gulf itself.
Are you referring here to the bombing of chemical plants and nuclear weapons facilities?
And petrochemical facilities as well. And it's not just the military facilities, it's also the very advanced modern industrial facilities that are throughout Iraq and that are now considered a strategic target of the Allied Air Forces.
Do we know anything about how much of the dangerous chemicals get released into the air when a chemical weapon facility is bombed, or how much radiation gets released into the air when a nuclear weapons facility is bombed?
I don't think that we can predict exactly how much will be released. It depends on what quantities of chemicals are stored on site, I think, is the most important variable. And perhaps the military intelligence has some sense of this. I don't think that those of us who don't have access to that kind of secret information can really predict for sure. But one thing that we can point to, just as an example, the tragic Bhopal accident that occurred in India several years ago, basically what happened there was that a storage tank ruptured that contained highly toxic chemicals. Certainly there is the potential for that kind of thing to occur, and hopefully it will not. But when you start dropping bombs on these kinds of facilities, almost anything can happen.
Chris, you're the Vice President for Research at the World Watch Institute, and every year, at more or less about this time, your institute issues something called the State of the World Report. So I'd really like to know what you're doing to monitor the effects of this war on the state of the world, because I'm sure it's something you have to be measuring and considering.
Well, one of the things that we're most immediately concerned about is the possibility that the global obsession with the Middle East conflict, and I've talked to people in several countries just in the last few days, and the obsession truly is worldwide, that could take away from attention to the ongoing environmental problems that are affecting almost every country in the world. So there is a real potential negative effect just in terms of delaying efforts to clean up the environment. So we're watching that very carefully, and we're also looking at ways in which we can, in effect, use this tragic situation to highlight for policymakers the fact that we have to be much more serious, for example, about efforts to reduce oil dependence. And if we can perhaps get a slight silver lining out of this tragedy if we can begin to turn around energy trends, not only in the United States, but around the world, and try to avoid the overdependence on oil, which has certainly in part been the cause of the current conflict.
What do you think the chances of that are?
I think it really depends on the outcome of the war. I think the longer it drags on and the more awful it is, in a way, the greater the pressure on policymakers to really turn things around. Politicians are always eager to forget about long-term problems and to sort of go back to doing things the way they have before. And there certainly are a number of politicians, including, unfortunately, many found in the current administration, that would like to forget about our energy problems as soon as the shooting stops. But I have a feeling that just given the enormous human and economic consequences of this conflict, that those of us who are fighting for a sane energy policy will be more successful than ever before.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks a lot, Terry.
Christopher Flavin is Vice President of Research at the World Watch Institute in Washington, D.C. Coming up, the rules of war. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. When Saddam Hussein threatened to use prisoners of war as human shields at strategic locations, the U.S. protested that that would be a war crime. There is a code of international law that governs what is the proper behavior to follow during a war. After World War II, the Geneva Conventions were drawn up to further clarify what is legal and what is not during war. Both the United States and Iraq have signed the Geneva Conventions. Our guest Alfred Rubin is a professor of international law at Tufts University. He was a lawyer for the Pentagon during the Vietnam War. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. She spoke to him about how it seems almost paradoxical that it's fine to kill soldiers in warfare, but if they're captured, then there's appropriate rules of behavior.
The laws of war in no way inhibit military victory. Laws of war allow for bloodshed, action in self-defense, affirmative attacking action, and all they do is try to restrict the injury done to people whose injuring whom does nothing to help your war effort. There's no restriction in the laws of war on hitting military targets. The object of the laws of war is to enable and encourage both sides to try to get the bloodshed over with as quickly as possible and to limit the slaughter and destruction to those things that make military sense. That all rests not on any humanitarian conception of war being evil, although heaven knows it is, but rather on a realistic notion that wars do happen, whether or not unjust causes on one or both sides. When they happen, it doesn't matter whether the cause is just. The object is to win, get it over with quickly, minimize the bloodshed, and get on with the business of decent life. From that point of view, of course you can shoot enemy soldiers who are going to shoot at you. You can bomb munitions factories. You can do whatever you like that contributes to your victory in the war. But once they've surrendered, or once you're dealing with non-combatants, once you're dealing with non-military targets and mere terror, experience of nations over the generations has been that terror is not an effective weapon. The result of say, terrorist attack in the United States would never be the surrender or the cowardice of the United States. It would be the gritting of teeth and the determination that this must not happen, and we would fight harder and never surrender. I see no reason to think that foreigners would behave any differently in those circumstances, and all the evidence is the other way. That's all the laws of war do, is wake up the military commanders to the notion that the sort of needless bloodshed is self-defeating and foolish.
President Bush has been calling Saddam Hussein a war criminal. Has Saddam Hussein committed acts that would be considered crimes under international law?
Yes, he has. There's no doubt in my mind that by targeting civilian targets or indiscriminately targeting cities, that Saddam has committed such acts. But whether there's any legal result that flows from these acts is another much more complicated question.
I guess you're referring to what might happen later, say if the United States does try Saddam Hussein as a war criminal. How would this be done? I mean, is there a court, a judge, a jury? Can you actually do something like that?
Yes and no. We did it, after all, after the Second World War in Nuremberg and Tokyo, and we set up a military commission in Manila, and we've had other trials of war criminals, strictly applying the international laws of war. But you might remember that in Nuremberg and Tokyo, these were international tribunals set up by the victorious Allies and could be seen by the defeated party and others as nothing but victors' tribunals. The normal way that wars end, acknowledging that war crimes occur on both sides in just about all wars, the normal way it ends is with people forgetting the crimes on the other side. just as the victors always forget their crimes. I mean, nobody on the Allied side was tried, for example, for the terror bombing of Dresden. And there's no reason to think, to expect that that would happen. Therefore, there's no legal compulsion. There's no tribunal readily available to try Saddam. And if at the end of the war we had custody of him and we did feel it was in our interest to try him, it would be very important to determine what audience we're playing for. Whom are we trying to convince that there is a law of war that binds Saddam? And that raises very serious questions. It seems to me we presumably have to try to set up a tribunal with the coalition partners and make certain that there are Islamic jurists on the tribunal able to consider the international law in the light of Islamic law and measure Saddam's acts by the law that the people living in the Middle East could understand was law and not simply a victor's tribunal aimed to hanging him.
I guess that does call into question if the code of international law that you study or that you follow, does that take into consideration Islamic law?
Yes, it does. And I know of no serious question that the international law and Islamic law are entirely compatible. For, among other reasons, the Islamic laws of war began to be codified in the 8th century A.D. by an Iranian Persian jurist named Shaybani. And there are other eminent works on the laws of war in Islam, which are quite clear. It may permit enslavement, for example, of the defeated people, but it does not permit rapine, pillage, indiscriminate targeting, and all sorts of other of the kinds of things that look pretty much as if what Saddam has ordered to be done in Kuwait. I know of no Islamic jurist who would really support Saddam's activities in Kuwait and perhaps elsewhere. Islam is not a bloodthirsty religion. It's a true religion growing out of the same roots that Judaism and Christianity grow out of.
To some people, the phrase war crimes is kind of strange because to them, ethically, war itself is a crime. So to distinguish certain acts within a war as crimes doesn't make sense to some. Do you ever think that way as you're interpreting this code of law?
Not really. That is, it seems to me that under my frame of reference, with war being a fact, whether or not justified, knowing that the law does not prohibit stupidity, no law has ever prohibited stupidity, and I don't think law can prohibit stupidity, that we do get into situations, therefore, in which we do something extremely stupid, like go to war in some indefensible circumstances. When you're confronted with a Saddam, for example, it seems to me that you have to make certain choices, and I think I think the choice of going to war was unnecessary and foolish, but we did it, and we did it through democratic processes, and there we are at war, and it seems to me that once we're at war, we then shift to another set of rules. It says, all right, whether we're here wisely or not, now the question is, what do we do? And there the laws of war come into play, and the notion of war crimes then says, all right, we win as quickly and painlessly as we possibly can. We bomb military targets. We destroy any enemy soldiers that have the capability of hurting us. We encourage them to surrender. We encourage the return to peace by demonstrating that we're not bestial. Then we have peace again. And it seems to me that that's the function of the laws of war. I see nothing inconsistent with humanity and humanitarianism with an effective operating set of the rules of war.
If the goal of the United States was to kill Saddam Hussein, would that be accepted under international law?
Well, that's questionable. I think it would be accepted because it seems to me that the leading general, commander-in-chief, or whatever he calls himself, who parades around wearing a gun at his side and likes to wear military uniforms, shouldn't be immune from the combat any more than the grunt on the front line should be immune from getting killed in combat. So I don't see anything wrong with killing the commander-in-chief as a matter of law. As a matter of policy, I don't know whether it's wise or not. It seems to me that circumstances change, and in many circumstances it would be unwise to kill the commander-in-chief.
Is it legal to use chemical weapons?
No, it is not. That's fairly clear. There's not only the 1925 protocol, but there's a 1972 convention on chemical and biological warfare. It's clearly illegal to use these certain kinds of chemical weapons, at least the kinds that Saddam has. There are questions on the margins, like whether tear gas is usable. That is, chemical weapons that don't do any permanent harm. But to kill people with chemicals is agreed to be illegal, and I know of nobody who would really disagree with that.
And biological weapons.
Same thing. Mm-hmm. The reason for the illegality is basically because they're futile as military weapons, unpredictable. Biological weapons can get out of control. Chemical weapons are not only, in humane purposes, senses, horrible, but they're in very restricted areas. They kill indiscriminately. They don't bring you a great military advantage. They normally stiffen the will to resist and convince the enemy that you're fighting against that he would rather do anything than surrender. They prolong the struggle for many, many reasons. They're just unacceptable.
How about nuclear weapons?
That raises other questions. It depends, in my opinion. Again, many of my colleagues disagree with me. Many American lawyers and foreign lawyers feel that nuclear weapons are, per se, as such, illegal. I don't agree with that, but I think the general rules of war really take care of them pretty well. And that is, a nuclear weapon dropped blindly on Baghdad would have results that are not sufficiently military, disproportionate results. That is, civilian damage disproportionately great compared to the military advantage, and I don't think that they would bring the war to a quick close, or if they did in Iraq, it would inflame the area and make it everything much worse on a political ground. I think it would be illegal and stupid. On the other hand, if you're dealing with a desert area that happens to have, some mobile Scud emplacements, and you can get rid of, and you don't know precisely where they are sufficiently for bombing to get rid of them. And the only way you can really get rid of an area of, say, 5 miles radius that you know has got military targets and very little else, I don't see anything in the law that inhibits your use of nuclear weapons to achieve that military goal without disproportionate damage. Now, whether it's wise is another question. It seems to me, again, the political result of using the nuclear device would be likely to be so serious, so destabilizing, that it seems to me it would be a very foolish weapon to use, even if it were legal.
What is the rule on retaliation?
There are technical problems here, whether retaliation is the same as reprisal and all sorts of other technical problems, but basically, the object of, I would prefer to call it reprisal, is to deter the enemy from continuing an illegal act that the enemy has already committed. The object is not to set straight the eternal scales of justice. Those can never be set straight. In fact, nobody knows what justice is except God, I suppose, and he hasn't told us because we hear him differently. The object of reprisals, then, is to deter the other side. In order to deter the other side, the reprisal is supposed to be related to the first illegal act. It's supposed to follow only other attempts to deter the enemy, to bring sense to him, and it has to be proportional. Now, proportionality is a subjective notion, and proportionality may differ from one analyst to another. There are specific restrictions on the law of reprisal. Under the Geneva Conventions, for example, which are binding as a matter of treaty law on about 160 parties, including everybody in the Middle East, including Israel, the United States, Iraq, Iran, everybody else. Under those conventions, reprisals against prisoners of war are forbidden. Reprisals against civilians are forbidden. It would be a war crime to attempt to match the other side's bestiality. They may be beasts, but that does not give you the authority to be beasts, and it's self-defeating if you try it. You simply bring the world down into an Armageddon situation, which nobody wins, and both sides lose their marbles and their friends.
When it comes to international law, which govern war crimes, can they really not be enforced?
Well, the normal enforcement of international law is done for very good policy reasons by the countries themselves who are involved in the war, enforcing their own version of the law on their own people. To violate the laws of war is really self-defeating. Laws of war really codify what could be called natural law, that is, the rules that you can predict will be important to maintaining the things you want to be maintain. For example, if you have a interrogator who thinks that he can get good information from a prisoner by torturing him, in the heat of battle, he may believe that, and he may wonder why there's a law that forbids it. Well, he'll find out that it's his own law that forbids it, and the reasons why are because people sitting down more calmly than he have focused on the fact that a tortured prisoner is likely to tell you whatever he thinks you want to hear and not the truth, and that a reputation for torturing prisoners means that the enemy is unlikely to want to surrender, and therefore they'll kill more of you guys before they give up the military target that they're defending. Well, that's self-defeating on two purposes. You don't get much advantage from torturing the prisoner, and you get a military disadvantage from a reputation as one who tortures prisoners, plus the fact of morale of your own forces, that you don't want to be fighting on a side that has professional torturers on its side. You also don't want to give the enemy an opportunity to claim reprisal, because you don't want to get tortured if they ever capture you. You don't want to scare your allies away by having them point out to you that they don't want to fight on the same side as a country that uses torturers. All sorts of reasons why, in its own national interest, the laws of war are enforced by the belligerents against themselves. That's the origin and enforcement of the laws of war primarily. The great war crimes trials, the international surveillance over this, the role of the International Committee of the Red Cross, and all of those are part of a pattern of persuasiveness that gets into it, and a pattern of victor's vengeance that gets into it when the war is over. And those things are of lesser importance and more newspaper headline stuff than the real laws of war.
Alfred Rubin is a professor of international law at Tufts University. He spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.